The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
What's going on, Long Island, New York City? My name is Andrew Claudio, and welcome to the 9 o'clock edition of Sports Talk 1240. Interact with us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240 or myself at Andrew Claudio. I'll be here till 10 o'clock. We've got Wallace Matthews of ESPN joining me to talk a little Yankees in just a little bit, as well as Howard Beck of Bleacher Report to talk about the Knicks and the NBA. So I've got those bases covered, which means you know where we're going to start. If you know anything about myself and the two shows I've done so far or anything I like to talk about, I'm going to be the Mets guy for right now. And we're going to talk about the Mets and their annual Let's Overanalyze a West Coast trip that they just had, where they went 4-7 against the Padres, the Dodgers, and the Rockies. And it's kind of an interesting feeling, because a week ago we thought that the Mets could move mountains and miracles could actually happen when Bartolo Colon went deep. On Wednesday, was it? Syndergaard went deep twice, and we all of a sudden thought that this is the type of year that the Mets were going to have, where anytime it looked like there was a reason to be disappointed or have sorrow, that they were going to have something happen that just shows you they have good karma. You know, when you look back at every championship team, like last year it was like this for the Mets, when you look back at all the great seasons, you start to pinpoint highlight moments, you know, the moments that'll make the World Series DVD at the end of the year. And last year for the Mets, it was that week where they traded Wilmer Flores and then he cried, and then they didn't trade Wilmer Flores and then they got Cespedes and went 19-5, and they had the 8 home run game where David Wright came back, and the walk-off by Flores, and the sweep in Washington, and their trip to Colorado last year where Cespedes hit 3 home runs. And then you get this year, you have Colon's home run, and you have the 12-run inning. Like, you've had moments like that so far. And now we're on a West Coast trip. You know, the Rockies, the Mets didn't score as much as I'd like them to in Coors Field. I'd like to considers Coors Field like a really small softball field where the runs, you really should set a home run limit for Coors Field, if you ask me. But that's neither here nor there. But having said that, I don't really know how to react to a bad road trip, because this happens to every Major League Baseball team. You know, you lose 60 games, and if you lose 60 games in a season, you won 102, which means you did well, but you still lost 60 games. So the Mets, they were a game out of first place. Am I supposed to panic? I'll tell you where you can panic, and it's in two places. One is with Matt Harvey. Dude, you were the guy that was so concerned about your innings limits. Now you're a year removed from Tommy John surgery, or any innings limits talks, and you're pitching in what we're going to talk about, the final 3 years you're going to be a Met. And, dude, really? This is the season? I haven't felt good about a Matt Harvey start yet this year, and I haven't panicked yet. I haven't been the type that said, you know, we should be nervous, but I'm at least concerned. He hasn't looked at all like the guy from last year, because one thing you saw from Matt Harvey, and it's the one thing that you're going to have to see from him going forward, is that his velocity was up and he had swing and miss stuff. He's still not walking anybody. He's still, you know, he looks fine. There's nothing mechanically when you talk to anybody that's wrong with him. It's just a funk. And I don't know how to explain it. I need to see him pitch an inning. I need to throw one pitch in the seventh inning. That more than anything else. And then I can and start to not worry about you. Because this is the guy that loves the spotlight and loves being courtside at Knicks games and front row at Rangers games, and loves being in New York City and the guy and being on Scott Boras's ticket. And now you can't rely on the fact that you're a phenom. At the moment, you're probably the Mets' fifth starter. So I'm a little concerned about Matt Harvey. And the other place I'm concerned, and it's tricky with how I'm concerned about this, because baseball for an everyday player is a long season. But Curtis Granderson, I'm not going to overreact too much to a 200 hitter in the month of May, because Curtis Granderson is very streaky. And last year he got off to a similar start, but the difference is he was getting on base. I've probably missed about six pitches of the Mets this season, and what I've seen from Granderson is his pitch selection is so much worse this year. He's swinging at balls in the dirt. He's not drawing walks. You know, last year when he wasn't getting hits, he was still on a pace for 100 walks and was okay being a leadoff hitter. This year, he's just a 200 hitter that's not even getting on base. And when you're batting number one in the lineup, you can't even depend on your two hitter because your two hitter is David Wright, who has been up and down with whether or not he's going to be a good two hitter. I've given David his credit as far as adjusting his approach, because there was a stretch of about 14 games where he drew a walk in every game, which is what you want from your two hitter, is just to get on base. There's nobody on this team that's going to steal 40 bases. The Mets are not a team with speed. But from the top of the lineup, one and two, get on base for Conforto and Cespedes and Duda and just go down the line. But if you're starting the game with two automatic outs at one and two, that's a cause for disaster. And when the Mets aren't hitting home runs anymore, which they haven't pretty much since last week, you get what just happened, this four-game losing streak. And it starts at the top of the lineup. Now, a lot of this could just be the fact that the Mets' last off day was April 28th. The Mets have not had an off day in the month of May. And I don't like to give the excuse that these are everyday players and they make so much money they can't get tired. They're human beings. They get tired. They're allowed to feel the wear and tear of a 162-game season, especially in the post-steroid era. Not saying anything, but, you know, anyway. All I'll say is this. I'm going to turn the page. You know, Coors Field was fun last year. The Mets swept the Rockies 7 out of 7 last year. Cespedes had that three-homer game, and it was fun last year. We now look to this season, and it's different. They were 0-3 at Coors Field, and I don't think they see the Rockies again for a while. Looking at their schedule now. I scrolled enough that where I don't see the Rockies, so they don't play the Rockies again for a while. That being said, we now look forward. And the best hitter in the National League in Daniel Murphy. And look, I'm sure there are better power hitters and guys having better seasons, but the 400 hitting Daniel Murphy comes into town. The best player in baseball in Bryce Harper comes into town. And the Mets are going to face the Nationals for the first time since the last weekend of the season where Scherzer had his no-hitter. By the way, if you want to look at matchups for this week, on Tuesday night, May 17th, you've got Noah Syndergaard against Max Scherzer, which is probably going to be one of the best pitching matchups all season. You've got the young phenom that throws 100 miles an hour, and you got the guy who just struck out 20 batters, which I can't even say anything bad about that. You go to Wednesday. You've got Gio Gonzalez against to be determined, which it could be Steven Matz. I'm glad to hear that there's nothing wrong with him and that it's just a precautionary thing where his elbow, because I don't know if many of you know this, he's already had Tommy John surgery, so that wasn't even a thought. It's if I hear Noah Syndergaard is out with elbow soreness, yeah, I'm going to be concerned, but I'm not going to be concerned about Steven Matz, because another Tommy John surgery means his career's over. That being said, you got Gio Gonzalez, two lefties most likely on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, right now it's Matt Harvey, and the Nationals haven't named a starter for that game either. It could be that the Mets have three of their better pitchers, or two of their better pitchers in Matt Harvey. Here's what I want to see. Take 2 out of 3, beat Scherzer, don't let Daniel Murphy go have one of his 8 for 12 series, you know, where he hits two home runs at his old ballpark. This is the type of thing that the Mets can rebound. And then you play the Brewers, who are going to lose 100 games this year. And then you go back to Washington. And you play 3 more games. And then we're in June. So if you want to close out and just make us all forget about this West Coast trip, which I don't even know how to react to it. I'm not concerned about a 4-7 road trip. A lot of baseball teams have that. I will be concerned if you lose 6 of your next 9 against the last place team and your biggest division rival. Because pardon me, I'm not that convinced about the Phillies. I think they're playing with fool's gold right now. I like them going forward. They have a ton of room, of a ton of payroll that they can spend next year. I almost said cap space. But they have a ton of money to spend, and they barely have anybody under the books this year. And they have young pitching, which if you're a Mets fan knows, you know how much young pitching can do for you. So we'll see. Should be a fun week for the Mets. If you're a pessimistic Mets fan, you're probably going crazy and the sky is falling. If you're a realistic Mets fan, you'd like to see them pick it up against the Nationals. But at the end of the day, this is May, and these are six games that are going to be just going to tell you exactly what to expect for the rest of the summer. And I think more than anything, what we saw from the Mets the last 11 games is that this team isn't as perfect as they seemed to be earlier in the year. This team isn't as flawless as we wanted them to seem when they were hitting all these home runs and doing what they were doing in the month of April and sweeping the Reds and taking 2 out of 3 from the Giants and that 7-game win streak when they swept the Braves. This is a flawed team. This team is not perfect. However, I still think they're going to win 95 games. I still think that they got the best pitching staff in baseball. Got a ton of time to turn this around. If I'm a betting man, I'm pretty sure they will. Well, that's enough about the Mets. We're now going to talk about the Yankees when we come back. I've got Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com on the other side of this.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Talk 1240, everybody. Andrew Claudio here. Hit us up on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, as well as hit up me, Andrew Claudio, at Andrew Claudio. That's Andrew CL Audio on Twitter. Hit us up with some questions about the sports world. We just talked a little Mets. Now we're going to talk a little Yankees with a pre-recorded interview I did with Wallace Matthews. And here's the beauty of pre-recording interviews with guys when they're available. Wallace Matthews, who was awesome enough to answer my phone call on Friday, answered some questions that would pertain to the Yankees as of Friday at 5:15. Unfortunately, three of those questions got answered more in depth during the weekend. So here's the deal. We are going to play this interview, and then afterwards we're going to recap what pretty much doesn't exist anymore about the interview and talk about the answered questions that were answered this weekend, as the Yankees are actually one of the hottest teams in baseball. Winners of 7 out of 10. They took 2 out of 3 from the first place Red Sox, 2 out of 3 from the first place White Sox, as well as 3 out of 4 from the defending world champions. The bullpen looks like it's going to work. If this team's going to hit and at least give them some run support, they need to figure out a way to strengthen the rotation, but they can shorten games like they have over the past week to 6 or 7 innings, because they do have, if all three of these guys are healthy, the best bullpen in baseball. Just my opinion. Anyway, here is my interview with Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com. My first guest this evening, his name is Wallace Matthews. He works at ESPN.com. Wallace, how are you today, sir?
Really well, Andrew. How are you?
I'm good. Can't complain. Again, you can find Wallace's tweets at ESPN NY Yankees. That's all caps until Yankees. And you can find all of his stuff at ESPN.com, where his latest article was about Chase Headley and his first home run of 2016, including his first extra base hit. And it's all right. We're going to start there. On this show, a lot of Met and Yankee fans and their interactions, it seems like Met fans had a little too much fun with Bartolo Colon having more extra base hits than Chase Headley. You've worked with him. You've seen him throughout this. How has he dealt with what is safe to say the worst start of his professional career?
He deals with things pretty well. He's a pretty low-key guy. I don't think he really, obviously you've got to go through some degree of worry when you're hitting as badly as he was. But, I mean, it's a professional baseball player. This guy knows that over time, things are pretty much going to even out. Now, he said that he admitted that there was some concern, but he knew that he wasn't going to hit like that all season long. Now, the question is, does, one good game turn everything around for Chase Headley? That's, that remains to be seen, because let's not forget, the manager loved to point out that we don't condemn a guy for 50 bad at-bats, but we also don't put him in the Hall of Fame for, two good ones.
Right. Now, I think what's also helped him a little bit is he really has no need to look over his shoulder. Like, the Yankees really didn't have another option to go to a third base.
Oh, so you don't think Ronald Torres is pushing him to take over the third base job?
Well, seeing as how $13 million kind of earns you the way to hit out of a slump like this, I think he was safe.
Well, in theory, a guy's paycheck is not supposed to guarantee him a job. In theory, the guy who's best at the position is supposed to be playing the position. We know that, obviously, that doesn't always happen.
Right.
We heard a lot of the same things with CC Sabathia and the number five starters competition in spring training. But you know what? They gave it to him, and he fits well.
Well, if we're going to think outside of the box at a backup third baseman, Ref Snyder, he's hitting really well at Scranton right now. Is there any talk of him coming up and potentially playing third base?
Zero.
Okay. Again, this is out of the box. That's all.
Yeah, I understand that, but you don't play balls off your face in the major leagues. And actually, recently they moved him back out to right field, and I don't know if that's because the third base experiment wasn't going all that well, or because they have a need in the outfield with Ellsbury out of the lineup.
Well, speaking of guys getting called up to the big leagues, and again, we're talking to Wallace Matthews from ESPN.com. Gary Sanchez is going to play today. He's starting a DH tonight against Chris Sale. What's the plan with him? How long is his stay going to be at the Major League club?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, he'll clearly be here for tonight and tomorrow because their left-handers going both games. Girardi left open the possibility that he'll stick around a little bit longer. Obviously, with Alex Rodriguez on the DL, you could use a right-hander hitting DH. Didn't sound like they have any plans using behind the plate. When he's here, he'll be a right-handed hitting DH. And whether he stays beyond tomorrow's game remains, I think, it really depends on how well he does in the next two games. And obviously, they did him no favors tonight because he's got to face Chris Sale.
Now, speaking of guys that we just recently saw this week, Aroldis Chapman is back. As far as the plan for the bullpen, I shouldn't even say back. He made his debut. As far as the plan for the bullpen, when are we going to see Betances, Miller, Chapman in a 7th, 8th, 9th inning scenario?
I'm not sure that's really what Girardi wants to do. I think he'd rather alternate the two setup guys to keep them fresh, and maybe even use one of them as closer at certain times to keep Chapman fresh. You obviously can't use all three of those guys every night or even three or four times a week. That would be too much. So, I'm not really sure that's the plan. I think the real plan here is to find a guy who's reliable to get them from the starting pitcher to the setup man. Obviously, Kirby Yates has done a pretty good job at that. Shreve in the past has done well at that. But I don't think they really want to go 7, 8, 9 with the Panthers, Miller and Chapman on a regular basis. You will see it at times.
Is Girardi open, and I'm sure he is, to using Chapman in potentially in the 8th inning, or is this a 1-inning pitcher?
I think he's a one-inning pitcher. I mean, you know what? The subject really hasn't come up, and, you know, Girardi doesn't really like to use his back-end guys for more than three outs. And, you know, we saw it last week with Andrew Miller got a four-out save. But, you know, that's generally not what he likes to do. You know, so, and we haven't seen the situation that called for yet. But clearly when there's a game where he thinks, I got to win this one, and he thinks Chapman is the guy to get the out. But I just don't see why you would pull out Andrew Miller, who's also a lefty and pretty damn good himself, you know, with two outs in the eighth inning to bring Chapman in.
Again, we're talking to Wallace Matthews from ESPN.com. Severino goes tonight, and the funny thing is this isn't going to air until Sunday, so the answer to my question might come before Sunday, but is he pitching, is it a start-to-start thing that he's pitching to stay in the majors?
Well, they say no, you know, and Girardi says that he saw good things in him in the last start, even though he gave up three home runs. I guess when you give up two of them to David Ortiz, that's a built-in excuse, but Girardi says he's seen improvement in him and says they're counting on him. He says that it's never even come up in discussion, the possibility of sending him you know, back or taking him out of the rotation. They're relying on this guy.
Ev, just from your judgment, if he's still pitching like this when CeCe's healthy, is he the one that goes down?
It depends. I mean, you know, as I said, Girardi thought he pitched well against Boston. I might take issue with that. But the manager thought he pitched well, so if he pitches a similar game tonight, you know, we'll have to see what he says, you know, on Friday, I should say on Friday night. If he pitched the same game against the White Sox, you know, we'll see if Girardi thinks that that's good enough to keep him around. But as of now, it doesn't seem like he's imminently coming out of the rotation.
Well, same question, but now Michael Pineda, if he's still struggling, I guess my question would be is who comes out when CeCe comes back?
Well, I think the obvious one would be Nova, you know, and Girardi said he completely rejected the suggestion the other day that Pineda might come out, although it was a perfectly legitimate question. A guy with numbers like he's put up, you know, generally would be on the bubble, but he says, you know, it's not even something that's been discussed. So seems like, you know, here's the problem. Who do you replace him with?
Well, that's where CeCe coming in to be the fifth starter.
No, that'll replace Nova, because Nova's a replacement starter. You know, okay. So that's an easy one. But if you're going to start taking out, you know, your number three and four starters out of the rotation, you know, who do you plug back in? No major league team has a surplus of starting pitchers who are sitting around waiting to pitch.
Well, I think the positive sign you see with Pineda is as the game goes along, he gets better. So it's really just fixing the first or second inning issues. You know?
Well, I love that. You know, I heard you already say the other day, well, you take away the first inning, and you pitch finally. You can't take away the first inning with part of the game. All
right, he'd be an all-star, you know, if he took away the first inning, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, you could say that just about every time a pitcher loses. Well, you know, if not for that one inning, you would have done fine. Sorry, that's not an excuse. That's part of the game.
Again, we're talking to Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com. I'm going to play a little game with you, and it's called How Healthy Is He? I'm going to name a player, and you just tell me how healthy he is right now.
I know who the first player is going to be.
A Jacoby Ellsbury.
What a shock. Yeah. How healthy is he? Well, he hasn't played in 7 days. So, and I watched him run yesterday, and he didn't run all that fast. And he didn't run on the dirt, so I would have to say he's not healthy enough to play today, probably right. Not healthy enough to play tomorrow.
Is there any...
go to Arizona with the team.
If he doesn't go to Arizona, is it safe to assume we're looking at a trip to the DL?
Of course. Of course. I mean, at this point, you're right up against that anyway. I mean, you've already lost him for 7 days, probably eight. You know, I can't imagine he can come back tomorrow against a tough lefty like Quintana. You know, yeah, I think at this point, you know, you've been playing short for quite a while. I think it's time to maybe look into it.
Mark Teixeira.
I think he's all right. He seems fine. I mean, you know, 2 days with the next spasm. You know, the question is what will be the next thing with him, because we've seen it for the past couple of years. But I think for now his health is passable. He saw him make a couple of really good diving plays last night, so clearly, you know, neck wasn't bothering him.
Now, this is... he hasn't shown any sign of not being healthy, but this is always a fair question to ask about this next guy, is Carlos Beltran.
Oh, no, I think he's fine. I think he's fine. I think he's healthy. I think his health problem is that he's 39 years old. You know, but I tell you what, he's one of the best bats in their lineup. You know, had been earlier. You know, sorry, he slumped a little bit, but I think he's okay. You know, I don't think he's a great outfielder anymore, but I think he needs to go hit.
And now the two guys that are on the DL, I guess my question would be with A-Rod and CeCe is, who do we see first? Are they scheduled to come off the DL? Are they going to come off the day that they're scheduled to come off the DL?
they seem more optimistic about CC than about Alex. CC's going to throw a bullpen today, and we'll know better, you know, after the game how that went. Alex was kind of evasive yesterday when I asked him, you know, will you be ready to come out, you know, come back on the 18th? And so we'll see how the running goes. And he kind of just jogged yesterday, so you know, it doesn't look like he's let's put it this way. If he was supposed to come up with the DL tomorrow, he wouldn't be playing. you know, between now and next Wednesday, we'll see.
Okay, again, we got Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com. If you want to look at the low point for this season as the game against the Orioles where they lost 1-0 in extra innings, it seems like they turned it around since, but if you ask Yankee fans, they've kind of been in panic mode, is from what I've been able to tell so far this season. Does the clubhouse hear that? Has that had any effect on this team so far this season?
No, it really doesn't. You know, listen, professional baseball players don't really pay a lot of attention to that. They don't pay a lot of attention to what we say either. You know, look, they're 5 games below 500. It's only May. It's a long way to go. They could easily, you know, play themselves back into contention. Look, they had a horrible start. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, they weren't as bad as they looked in April. And probably not as good as they looked against the Royals, you know, winning 3 out of 4 games. They're somewhere in the middle. I mean, look, this is not a great team. It's an aging team. It's a team that has a lot of question marks, but I think it can play a lot better than it has for the first 7 weeks of the season.
Now, last question for me, and it's right up your alley. It's probably the most important question I'm going to ask you today, okay?
Okay.
Do you want to see a Floyd Mayweather Conor McGregor fight?
No.
No.
Well, listen, let me just, you know, I've seen so many ill-informed opinions on this and columns and just stupid questions. If Floyd Mayweather is going to fight Conor McGregor, he's going to insist that they fight a boxing match.
Right.
All right? Because this is a guy who doesn't even take chances when he's boxing, where he's the best in the world at it. If you think you're going to take the chance of fighting this guy in an MMA match, you're crazy. You'd fight him in a boxing match, and if he did, he would knock him out within 1 minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't see...
Conor McGregor's very easy to hit.
Right. I don't see a scenario where Floyd takes the fight. He doesn't need the money. He doesn't need the publicity. Like you said, the only way he would take the fight would be if it's boxing. And why put your...
Yeah, but you don't know with Floyd. He's ego-driven, and he does spend a hell of a lot of money. He gambles a lot of money. Don't ever say a guy doesn't need the money. You don't know.
Right.
You don't know the way these guys spend. If they went through the numbers and he figured he could make $100 million and he could say to Conor McGregor, I can make you $50 million, you got to box me, I think they would do it. And also, he might be getting tired of hearing, you know, these MMA fans say, oh, well, put him in there with Floyd Mayweather, he'll kick his ass, you know.
Right.
Guys, just say, hey, you know what? Let's just
nip
this in the bud.
Yeah, I'm with you. Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com. You can follow him on Twitter at ESPN Yankees. Excuse me, ESPN NY Yankees, as opposed to the other Yankees. Wallace, thank you for your time, man.
My pleasure. Take care, Andrew.
That was Wallace Matthews of ESPN.com. You can read all of his articles at ESPN.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter at ESPN NY Yankees. Let's recap real quick. So I asked about Gary Sanchez, how long he's going to be in the major leagues. Literally got sent down 2 days later, which makes sense because I'm pretty sure he just got called up for right-handed help because they don't have Alex and they needed a right-handed bat for the two lefties they were going to face on Friday and Saturday. And so he gets sent down, and if you're not going to play him at catcher or first base, you're going to the West Coast to play a National League team. Not the West Coast, because Arizona's not the coast. But if you're going to play in a National League ballpark, you don't need an extra right-handed bat to just be a DH. So, better to get him every day at bat. So, that makes sense. The bullpen. I asked, when is the first time we're going to see the 7-8-9 inning scenario of Betances, Miller, Chapman? He didn't know. He didn't think Joe was going to do that. And yet, what happened on Saturday and then on Sunday, back-to-back days of 7-8-9? Which I do think Wallace is right. Long term, you want to spread these guys out, and you hope that your rotation gives you 7 innings so that you only have to use 2 of these studs in the bullpen. However, it is a great weapon to have that if your starter doesn't have it, I actually think you could throw one of these guys, like you could bring Betances in the 6th, stretch him for 5 outs, Miller for 5 outs, and then go with Chapman in the 9th. You know? So that answers the bullpen. As far as Severino's concerned, He's on the disabled list with the tricep injury. Personally, I think this is just good for him so he can get away from baseball for a couple weeks. With young starting pitchers, when you're struggling in your first full season in the majors, sometimes it's good to just take a step back. There's no demotion involved. You didn't have to, because with young starting pitchers or just any young baseball players, a demotion to AAA feels like you failed, and it can go one of two ways. You know, you look at what happened with Travis d'Arnaud a couple years ago. He got called up during one season, had an okay start, and then as the everyday catcher was terrible for the first 2 months of the season. The Mets sent him down. He had as good a week of baseball that you could have at AAA. I think they were in Buffalo at the time. I don't know if they were at Buffalo or Vegas, but regardless, he then came back and showed he could be an everyday catcher in the major leagues. I think just let Severino take a break, give him 2 weeks off. He comes back and you just work on mechanics, because he's no longer looked at as the ace now that the bullpen can come in and just tell him, get me six innings, get me a quality start, and we will have our bullpen come in and get your wins back up. So that's Severino. Ellsbury, I asked if he didn't play at all during the weekend, we're looking at a trip to the DL. Well, he came in as a pinch runner or a defensive replacement on Saturday, and then he started today. So Ellsbury's back. Look, the Yankees are 16-20, which, big picture, if you just landed on planet Earth and looked at the Yankees, they're a last-place team. But in a vacuum, look at the last 10 days. They've played much better. They're hitting much better. And you now have the three-headed monster in the bullpen that was supposed to be your biggest strength at the beginning of the season. So it'll be interesting to see. You also have to take into account the teams they just beat. This wasn't three last-place teams that they just took 7 of 10 from. This is the defending world champions and two first-place ball clubs. So the Yankees now head to Arizona, which you can add on to that. And who knows, maybe in a week or so, the Yankees are a 500 team again. And then your season somewhat restarts. And again, you have guys coming back. You have A-Rod coming back. You have CeCe coming back. And eventually you're going to have Severino come back. So we'll see with the Yankees. Baseball's a long season. You know, Met fans, as I said earlier, if you want to panic, go right ahead. I'm not going to. These teams, you know, the Mets last year, for so much of the season, it felt like the sky was falling. This is going to be the loss that puts the nail in their coffin. This is going to be the road trip that ends their season. And it just kept going and kept going. And if you just, you hover around a certain point, sometimes something clicks. For the Mets last year, it was that week where they traded Wilmer Flores, but then didn't, but then traded for Cespedes, and then they went 19-5 in the month of August. Sometimes it just takes the moment for a baseball team to click. It seems like it's already happened for the Cubs, but we'll see. Probably the next time I'm on in the month of June, the Yankees might be over 500. So,
joining me now is Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. He's also the host of NBA Sunday Tip on Bleacher Report Radio. That's every Sunday from 11 to 1 p.m. Howard, how are you tonight, sir? Thank you for joining me on Sports Talk 1240.
I'm doing great, thanks.
Now, I like to give plugs to work you've done recently, and I listened to the episode 1 of the Ringer's NBA show with Bill Simmons. Great job, by the way. But as you were talking about how there's no New York team in the playoffs, as a New York basketball fan, I kind of got a little depressed that the Knicks are, what, four years removed from that 54-win team that was the 2 seed and beat the Heat 3 out of 4 years. What would you say is, how did it get to this point? Where did it go wrong?
It's not that it went wrong. It's that that team, I don't believe, was ever built to be sustainable in the first place. That 54-win season was a bit of an aberration, just in the sense that they, you know, put the exact right pieces around their core, and at that time the core was, you know, Carmelo, Amari, and Tyson Chandler still, and they brought in Jason Kidd and Kurt Thomas and Rasheed Wallace and Marcus Camby. And while not all of those guys played a lot, that veteran core that they brought in got Carmelo Anthony and J.R. Smith in particular to play their best seasons of their careers, in essence. Jason Kidd in particular, held everybody to account. And so you got the best version of everybody that year. But also critically, and I've always been a big Amari guy, but Amari got hurt. And Mike Woodson was forced to go with a small lineup with Carmelo at power forward. And everything clicked. And Carmelo and Amari had never clicked. But using that small lineup, running spread pick and roll, using Kidd and Tyson Chandler, initiating things, and then Carmelo Anthony, J.R. Smith, the rest of these guys playing off of that lineup worked really well. But it also only worked for certain spans of the season. They were a 500 team for the middle 3 months of the season, but they had a really hot start and a really hot finish, and it got them to 54 wins. But guys broke down along the way. The older guys, they got rid of those guys. They all moved on. Kidd retired. And suddenly you lost all of that support system. The chemistry changed. And so that next year, they dropped to 37 wins, and that team was never going to be the same again. Amari came back. They couldn't quite incorporate him in the same way or reincorporate him and still be functioning at the same high level. It just wasn't built to last. It never was. It was fool's gold. And, you know, I think Phil Jackson made a mistake in thinking that he could, when he came in, try to patch up that team and try to ride it out or extend it. And once he realized his mistake, he tore it down instead, which I think has been the right move.
Well, I guess that would be my next question as far as Phil Jackson's patch job. Was he surprised how bad the team was, not this past season, but the year before when they won only 17 games?
No, listen, the way things went, you know, I mean, Phil Jackson, I think, you know, realized that he had to move Tyson Chandler for various reasons. And that trade didn't net them enough in return. So that was a bit of a miscalculation. But also what they had at that point going forward with J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert, those guys, that group just wasn't – there wasn't enough high talent there and certainly not enough high character there for that team to be a winning team. So you know, once you recognize that it's not going the right direction and you don't have a lot of picks to work with because of previous administrations that have traded them away, you course correct. But that course correction basically got rid of, the only handful of guys who were still capable starters. And then remember, Carmelo Anthony missed half the season. Everybody forgets this. The 17-win season, Carmelo Anthony was gone for half the season, and the half he did play, he had a bad knee, so he wasn't himself. That's the biggest factor in that 17-win season, but it gets overlooked.
I think, and again, we're talking to Howard Beck of Bleacher Report. I think one of the big questions that Knicks fans have about Phil Jackson is how involved he is with the team and just how hands-on he's been with the team since he took over. You'd obviously know better than we would. Is he at every game? Is he that in tune with the team?
He's at just about every home game that I'm aware of. I don't go to every home game though I'm based here, so I couldn't, you know, verify his attendance record specifically, but he's been at the vast majority of the home games since he took the job. He's not going to a ton of road games. He was never going to travel a lot. It's travel concerns and travel, just the strains of travel that basically pushed him to stay retired from coaching in the first place. You know, he can't handle the rigors of the road. And so, you know, he goes the majority of home games. Look, a lot of GMs don't travel. Ernie Grunfeld doesn't travel with the Washington Wizards. There are plenty of other teams where the top guy, whether it's a team president or the GM, doesn't travel, and they have the assistant GM or how, you know, different teams have different structures. It's not like some mandate that GMs travel with their teams and go to every game of the season. It's just not, it's not tradition. You know, Jerry West, in the years that I covered the Lakers early on, Jerry West never traveled with the Lakers, never went to a single road game during my time covering that team. Mitch Kupchak didn't go to a lot of them either. So it's not crazy. It's not, but, you know, hands-on is a different question. Hands-on means, are you actually running the day-to-day? You know, do you have your hand on the pulse of the team and on the structure of the team? That's where he came in to try to get things moving in a different direction, is to direct the team, is to, you know, put in place a structure. I'm not sure how well he has done that, you know, a couple of years in, but he is heavily involved in everything. But he's got like most front offices, you've got other guys to do the scouting, to run the day-to-day, to do a lot of the networking with agents that Phil Jackson doesn't really want to do. So Steve Mills now in Houston and Mark Workenteen and the rest of that staff, that's their job.
Again, we're talking to Howard Beck of Bleacher Report. As we were talking about that, I was trying to remember if I've seen Pat Riley at a road game. That's actually a very good point. You don't have to be, you know, day-to-day with the team to be that hands-on. As far as his structure and his plan, your best guess, who's going to be the coach of the team next season?
I mean, best guess is that it's going to be Kurt Rambis, but I don't think that that's a certainty yet. If it were, they probably would have already made that announcement. I think they are at least exploring, and, you know, it's hard to get a handle sometimes on what Phil Jackson's thinking and doing because he doesn't give away much of his hand. This is not a guy who's going to leak stuff. If they're talking to people, it may be going on quietly. Or maybe they're just, you know, laying low for the time being, and, you know, maybe they've already made their decision and it's going to be Kurt Rambis and they just are deciding to delay the announcement for other reasons. I don't know. Hard to refill sometimes.
Is it safe to say that if a coach is not willing to run the triangle, that they're not a candidate for the Knicks job?
I don't think that that's an absolute. I think that that's simply Phil Jackson's strong preference, not just a preference, but a strong preference. But I don't think it's an absolute requirement. I think if they found somebody who, you know, what Phil Jackson has talked about often is what he refers to as system basketball. Not the triangle specifically, but system basketball. The triangle system he prefers overall, but he likes and appreciates and absolutely respects what the Spurs run because it involves ball and player movement. It's not just two guys running a pick and roll and everybody else standing around waiting for a kick out. He hates isolation basketball. He hates two-man basketball. He wants a system where everybody's integrated, where you read and react and you think. And the Spurs do that. The Hawks do that. The Warriors do that. So he has high regard for all of those teams and what they do. If somebody ran, you know, those offenses and he liked and connected with that person, of course he'd consider him.
Again, we're talking to Howard Beck of Bleacher Report. Also your best guess. And I want to be careful how I ask this because the guy signed a 5-year contract. He's not going to leave unless the right situation presents itself. But is there a potential situation where Carmelo Anthony would waive his no-trade clause?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, his heart is in New York, and then he wants to, you know...
He loves it here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. His preference, I'll use the phrase strong preference. Carmelo Anthony's strong preference would be to stay. But I think he'd have to be feeling like things were either hopeless or that he's just too frustrated or that he just doesn't see enough progress quickly enough, then maybe he gets there. I don't know what it would take for him to decide to waive the no trade clause or request a trade, but it really is in his hands. You know, Phil Jackson's made it pretty clear when he was asked about this months ago. He said, hey, it's not our choice. He has a no-trade clause, so if he wants to be traded, that's up to him. And I said this on Simmons' podcast, I believe that maybe that's part of the reason why Phil Jackson gave him the no-trade clause in the first place, so that if it ever came to it, it wouldn't necessarily be on his hands, that it would be, you know, Carmelo who would have to assertively make the move to get out. You know, this goes back to fundamental questions about what Carmelo Anthony wants out of his career. And I've raised these questions before rhetorically. What does he want? Does he want just, you know, the glory of playing, you know, in New York and that spotlight? And does he want, you know, is it about money? Is it about fame? You know, what's it about for him? If it's about winning championships, then I thought he should have left a few years ago. He should have gone to Chicago. He should have gone to Houston. He should have gone somewhere else. But he returned, and to me that said that, you know, some people look at it as loyalty, okay, maybe, but he also stayed where he got the most money, and he's always chosen the money at the various stages in his career. and he's entitled to. But that has come at a cost because it has put him in positions where he hasn't been on teams that were ready to contend. And, you know, he knew that this one, that this situation was going to require some work. So, if championship contention is most important to him, then I could see him getting to the point where he requests a trade, because I don't think they're getting there that soon here. Porzingis is going to need a few years to develop. It was a surprise, or a pleasant surprise for the Knicks, how quickly he became an impact player in year one. But he's not going to, you know, assuming that he's on trajectory to be a true star, that still may be a year or two away to be able to carry a team. And by that point, Carmelo's, you know, firmly in his mid-30s, and, you know, their horizons just don't line up.
I think you could even go further back with Carmelo with just how he came to the Knicks. You know, that trade that he forced to become a Knick, when he could have just signed in that offseason, where he, if I remember right, he got traded here so that way he could sign the bigger contract before the lockout and the cap change, right?
It was what was referred to at the time as an extended trade, something that they basically, you know, took out of the next collective bargaining agreement. But yeah, he wanted to be traded because he wanted to have that extension that was going to be hand in hand with the trade, so that it would be assured and signed before there was the lockout, because he was afraid that the lockout was going to dramatically change the terms that he could have signed under. So he got, it was a $65 million 3-year extension. And he was afraid that he wouldn't get the same money if he'd waited to sign in free agency after a lockout. And as it happened, he wouldn't have really lost much. But it was, yeah, so when I say, you know, he's made a lot of money-driven decisions, that was among them. And, yeah, forcing the trade meant the Knicks gave up a ton of pieces, including picks, including, you know, a bunch of starting-caliber players. And, you know, it drained their resources. And it took some time to try to, you know, to get enough pieces around him. As a result, Carmelo himself has acknowledged that.
I even think the bigger one, because they got Chauncey Billups from Denver in that trade, right?
Yeah, but that was part of the problem, is that...
Right. I'm more saying, because they got Billups, they then had to use their amnesty, which a lot of people have pointed to. They could have used that on Amari, which would maybe led to Chris Paul. Like, you can get into different theories with what would have happened if he didn't force the trade there, you know?
Well, this is where Jim Dolan stepping in and hijacking the trade negotiations really hurt them, because it expanded. Instead of it being a trade for Carmelo strictly, it was the Nuggets then putting Chauncey in there as well. Chauncey at that point is like 34. He's starting to slow down. Of course, he got hurt in his playoff run with the Knicks almost immediately, and that was it for him. And if it had just been for Carmelo, the Knicks wouldn't have had to put in as many pieces. But because Chauncey was in there too, they ended up having to put in that many more pieces. And yeah, one, they ended up using the amnesty on Chauncey to make room to sign Tyson Chandler. That kept them from having the amnesty available, as you point out, for Amari. But also all the pieces that they sent out to get both Chauncey and Carmelo, those are pieces that they could have used to try to trade for Chris Paul or trade for somebody else. And so, you know, people often try to frame it or defend the trade by saying, oh, well, you know, Gallinari got hurt anyway, and really he's not that great. Mozgovo, you know, he wasn't that great. Wilson Chandler, who cares? Raymond Felton, who cares? Well, but these were all useful pieces at the time. And, you know, as we've seen, Mozgov actually, you know, be turned into a pretty good center. They're all useful pieces, and they were pieces that could be used to make other deals. It's not whether or not you won that trade. You get the star in the trade, you've always won the trade. But, you know, I think we can look back now on 5 years of you know, their progress or lack thereof and say they didn't really win the trade. You know, I mean, maybe nobody won. But the bottom line is they gave up so many assets, again, including picks, and then the pick swap, which is going on in this draft, that it kept them from having the resources to make other moves.
Dang it, Howard, I'm depressed again. Man, let's talk about the current NBA playoffs. Again, we got Howard Beck of Bleacher Report. When this airs, finally, the Heat and Raptors series will end. Which, do you watch superhero movies at all?
I've seen a few.
Okay, I kind of compare the Thunder and the Warrior series we're about to see to the new Captain America movie, Civil War. As in, everybody loves it and enjoyed it. And this Heat Raptors series has been like Batman v Superman, like that bad of a basketball series. Do either of these teams have a chance against the Cavaliers? And I get it, everybody has a chance, but realistically?
No.
Okay,
none.
Good answer.
Zero. I mean, you know, the only chance that anybody has is that the Cavaliers are rusty and overconfident. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. Do we put any stock in potentially a 12-0 Cavs team against the Warriors?
Well, look, I mean, if the Cavs are 12-0 going into the finals, that'll be an achievement of some sort. It's nice, but look, the Eastern Conference is not the Western Conference, and the Cavs will not have beaten anybody of the caliber of the Warriors or the Spurs or the Thunder or even a full health Clippers team. You know, that, you know, those four teams are better than anybody else in the East, you know, other than the Cavs. And I think those four teams at full health are probably better than the Cavs. So, you know, the Cavs have had pretty much of a cakewalk through the Eastern Conference, and that's fine. You know, you play the teams that are on the schedule. And just as nobody should try to cheapen what the Warriors did last year, no one should cheapen what the Cavaliers are doing right now. But to say that 12-0 is, if that's the case, is a hugely impressive achievement, no. I mean, you have to look at who they've played. So their true test will be in the finals, probably against the Warriors, and we'll see then. And it's, you know, that's the matchup I think most people wanted to see anyway, is let's see them at full strength. They didn't get all their players on the court for the finals last year. They didn't have that benefit. And, you know, I think the rematch is what everybody wants. We can, you know, finally settle that question of whether they could have or would have beaten them with everybody available.
It's funny. A month ago, I think the narrative about the Cavaliers was that we could see the Heat or the Raptors or a team in the East potentially knock them off in the playoffs, which would then raise questions about LeBron staying in Cleveland. And here we are, you know, on the verge of the Eastern Conference Finals, and it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to go to the finals pretty easily and potentially even win it all. Your best guess with LeBron, because you have covered the NBA for as long as you have, is there any scenario where he leaves at the end of this year?
No, I've never believed that. I don't know.
Me neither. Yeah.
I don't know who would be even peddling that. I mean, the idea that you know, somehow losing the finals or something would, or, you know, or being losing short of the finals would push him out. I've always said that, you know, if the Cavs don't win at all, and especially if they somehow fell short of getting to the finals, there would be consequences and there would be a breakup of that big three. But he's not the one going. You know, he's boxed himself in. His camp has tried to pretend otherwise and put it out there that, oh, he can walk. He's not walking. I mean, he made a huge deal out of going back and going back for reasons that were other than basketball, reasons that were about community and, you know, uplifting that region and, you know, unfinished business and all these other things that were, you know, more meaningful and deeper than basketball. And I believe a lot of what he said in his essay and in Sports Illustrated, but he's not, you know, those things have, I think, made it pretty clear that that's where he's going to be. I don't think he can leave again. I can, you know, you can only imagine the fallout that would come with that. So, no, he's not going anywhere. Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, maybe, but not LeBron.
Well, the only scenario I could see him possibly leaving, because as you said in your piece, he hinted at potentially wanting to play with Chris Paul and his buddies in the future. The only way I see that happening is either A, if it's in Cleveland, or B, if he's already won a championship in Cleveland, where he's somewhat done right by Cleveland, you know? And
yeah,
you just said
he
just said he can't leave. Like, he wouldn't be able to go back to Cleveland ever. Not even just the Cavaliers, like Ohio. He wouldn't be able to go near the border of Ohio again, you know?
No, and that's home. And, you know, the fantasy of playing with those guys, you know, probably unlikely to happen. But, you know, it's not even a worthy discussion at the moment.
Two questions, and I'll let you get out of here. Did we see the last game of Tim Duncan's career the other night?
Probably, but, you know, I don't know that definitively, and nor does anybody else. But it certainly seems that way.
Is he crazy? Does he know that only Kobe Bryant's allowed to retire this year? Like, did he miss that memo?
Yeah, it's, you know, but if he goes out just, you know, quietly fades away, that would be the very Duncan thing to
do. It's going to be like a fax, you know, it's just going to be really, I'm retiring. It's going to be as Tim Duncan as possible. Do the Thunder have, I'm not going to say a chance, but do we take stock in what they just did to the Spurs against the Warriors?
Yes.
Do we? Okay.
Yes. They knocked out a 67-win team, and they did it pretty authoritatively, and they did it despite having lost badly in game one, got their butts kicked, and then came back and won four of the next five games, and very definitively, you know, knocked them out in that game six. So, no, they're legitimate. I've always thought they were. They had their issues this season, but they seem to have fixed those along the way in terms of their defense. And, you know, we'll see how their fourth quarter execution and their defense holds up against a team as good as the Warriors, but they absolutely have a chance. I wouldn't rule them out at all. I think it's going to be a very competitive series.
I think what we can definitely say from as a result of that series, Kevin Durant's staying. I thought he was all along, but he's now 100% going to be in Oklahoma City next year.
That's a complicated one that we might have not have time to get into because I'm about to arrive at my destination here, but I think that I think there's still a chance that he's in play. We'll see how it goes against the Warriors first. A lot of people around the league have thought for months that they absolutely have a shot at him and that he's absolutely going to consider all options. And, you know, going to the finals maybe changes that. Winning a championship could change that. Losing to the Warriors in the conference finals, I think, still leaves it ambiguous.
Well, I'll let you go. Howard Beck, Bleacher Report. You can follow him on Twitter, at Howard Beck. Thank you for your time tonight, sir.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Howard Beck of Bleacher Report for coming on tonight's show, as well as Wallace Matthews of ESPN New York for coming on today's show. So, to wrap up, I'll give you a quick prediction for the NBA playoffs. I predict that the Warriors win in seven. I predict over the Thunder. I predict that I won't watch a second of the Raptors and the Cavaliers. And I'll leave that for now, that we'll get a Warriors-Cavaliers rematch, and that next month, when I'm back on in June, we'll talk about the NBA Finals, so that should be fun. Thanks again for everybody who listened online at the TuneIn app or sportstalk1240.com, or right here on Long Island here at 1240 AM WGBB. Follow the show on Twitter, at sportstalk1240, follow myself on Twitter, at Andrew Claudio. In Brian Graves on the other side of the glass. Thank you for doing the honors. And until next week, everybody, we are out of here.
Necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.